that fighting it out. So, Mark 4:17, these are people who have heard the word. They become believers. They receive it with joy. But they have no firm root in themselves, but are only temporary. And then, when affliction or persecution arises because of the word, immediately they fall away. So they're not very long lived in all of this. They don't survive very well, and in fact, ultimately don't survive spiritually. John 15:20. I think that's actually the one we just read. I didn't actually get to it, but the word I said to you, a slave is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you. And if they kept my word, they will keep yours also. And you can also see 2 Timothy 3:12. Suffering, loss of companionship and fellowship that results from applying separation. Mark 10, that's one of the things the believer has to face. You're going to lose relationships over the truth. I can guarantee it. And if they're not changed or gone, they will be altered forever. Because the truth changes things. And the truth changes people. This idea that, again, you can be exposed to this and either you're going to respond to it in faith and be changed and be glorify God and grow up, or you're going to rebel against it. And if you rebel against it, then you'll come under divine discipline and misery and all of that. So we all have choices. But again, when you get with the truth, this is going to upset certain people. They don't care for the truth. Whatever they say, they may have a good facade. I'm nice. I'm religious. I'm pleasant. I'm whatever. But deep down, they hate the truth. They don't want the truth. They don't want it at any level. And so they're enemies of God. Well, guess what? God's enemies become my enemies, unfortunately. And the sad thing is, of course, there are more enemies of God than there are friends of God. But the ones I'm going to go for are the friends of God. So he warns them there in Mark chapter 10, 34 through 37, about the things that were going to happen to him. That's actually not the right verse, I don't think. Oh, it's Matthew 10, no wonder. Okay, that makes more sense. Matthew 10, he warns them that I've come to bring conflict. I didn't come to get us all to hold hands and stand on a hilltop and drink Coke. I came to bring conflict. And kumbaya and all that, that's out the window. We're not going to stand around and sing that because we're in a warfare. And to teach believers otherwise is to do them a great disservice. And the enemies, unfortunately, are those of your own household sometime. Father, daughter, mother, daughter-in-law, mother-in-law. A man's enemies, verse 36, will be the members of his household. But if you love them more than you love me, then forget it. I'm not playing that game, Jesus says. And how do we know if you love them? If you put their word, their will, over his will. It's pretty easy. It's pretty easy to figure out who you love the most by who you obey the most. And so the royal imperatives are here for a reason. They set forth for us God's will as directed in the scriptures. And so they are the highest form of morality and authority that we have. Again, we make the scriptures the basis not only for our faith, but also for our practice. And so the scriptures are the highest level that we can appeal to, the royal imperatives. These tell me what God wants. And so there will be people that will tell you, no, that's not what God wants. You don't have to do that. You can do it some other way and all of that. Well, guess what? You'll find out you can't. Ultimately, you're going to find out you can't do it another way. So people will offer all sorts of compromises. I'll compromise with you. Well, no, I'm not here to compromise. I'm not going to compromise. I'm going to stand my ground. We're not here to debate whether or not the Bible's the truth. It's the truth. And it contains God's truth. And either you'll orient to it or you won't. And again, people that don't, this brings suffering. As we understand, even the closest relationships are affected. Sons, daughters, husbands, fathers, mothers, all this. That otherwise the relationships might be good if it weren't for doctrine. And that's what's sad. The relationships might otherwise be fine. I've met many people in this world that if it was not for doctrine, they were likable people. They had good qualities. But just flat out, many of them, just flat out unbelievers. And not interested in the truth. And even among the believers, very few of them are that interested in the truth. Many of them just are interested in doing it their way, what works for them. And we're not, again, going to play that game. So I met people, though. They're nice. My old boss out there at the rail side, Rolf, he was a great guy. A total opposite of what you'd expect of a Jewish lawyer. Completely nice, generous, charitable, kind. All the stereotypes you've heard about lawyers and Jews. He was none of those. He was just the opposite. Been great if he was on doctrine. But boy, when I'd mention anything about the Bible, his eyes would glaze. And he couldn't get away quick enough. And he just wasn't interested. I worked with another guy out there. Sat there in the same office with him day after day for however long I was out there. A long time, 15 years or something. And never brings it up. Never says anything about it. Never questions it. And he knows what I did. He knows what I do for a living. So, again, nice enough people. Treated me well. I'm happy with the relationship as far as it went. It just didn't go very far. Relationship was just simply all it's going to be is just me. I know you, but you're not interested in God, and I'm not going to be your friend, really. I'm not playing that game. Three, lupe, that's the Greek word for sorrow. From negative volition. Again, this can get into the close relationships that you end up losing because people will not orient. They're going to do it their way. We have a form of teaching to which we have been committed, and we're going to stick with that. Luke 13:34. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets. Here's Jesus. And stones those who were sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together, just as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you would not have it. And that's the problem. It's not so much that you wouldn't want a relationship with people that are negative, it's just that they don't want it. And that's sad. And again, this cuts across all lines. There's no the barriers here. Luke 19:41-44. I think this is where Jesus is approaching Jerusalem. Yeah. He's upset about the capital, his country. He knows what's coming on this country. He knows what's coming on the temple. He tells them, not one stone's going to be left on the other. I mean, this thing is going to be razed to the ground so thoroughly and completely. And there's going to be so much bloodshed and slaughter that it's really, when you go back and review the history, I mean, it's legendary what they did in there, the Romans. And they killed them. They went in and took the whole place, and they were glad to do it. Matter of fact, by the time they got in there, they were mad because the Jews dared try to withstand them. And so they unleashed the full force of Roman military might on them. And the slaughter was horrific. It was brutal. The nation was destroyed because of it. And the people that were left were sold off into slavery, ran for other countries to seek asylum, to flee. But their life was over. And Jesus knows this is coming. And he keeps warning them. And they won't listen. You keep warning and warning and warning. But if people don't listen, it doesn't do any good. And so he's warned them, and as he approaches, he saw the city and wept over it. If you had known, saying, if you had known, even you, the things which make for peace. But now they have been hidden from your eyes. For the days will come upon you when your enemies will throw up a barricade against you and surround you and hem you in on every side. And they will level you to the ground and your children within you. They will not leave in you one stone upon another. One of the favorite things of the Roman army was to slaughter the children right before they killed the parents. So the parent had to stand there and watch their kids get killed right before they got killed. There was an incident in the Old Testament where a particularly brutal king, I think it was Babylon, but I don't know, I'd have to double check. But this king rebels, this king in Israel, this vassal king, rebels against him. And so what he does is he slaughters all of his children right before him. And he doesn't kill him, he just puts out his eyes. So he makes him live the rest of his life blind with the last image watching your children be slaughtered. And so when people look at God and they think, well, I just want to sing about Jesus and the love of God and all of that. Well, that's not the whole picture. God is love, but he's also justice. And the fact is, when the justice comes down, it is brutal. And it's going to be brutal. Again, if you can imagine living here in America and you watch your child vaporize right before you vaporize, that wouldn't be too much fun. and any other slaughter even. So again, they're going to hem you in on every side, and they will level you to the ground, and they will not leave in you one stone on another, because you did not recognize the time of your visitation. This was the time you had to orient, and you blew it. And for us, today is the time. Now is the day to orient. And if you don't, you blow it, well, okay, then you'll pay the price down the road. And that's not good. We don't want that. Also, you can see Romans 9, 1 through 3, where Paul bemoans the fact that his countrymen are all negative, largely. The vast majority. There's a remnant he knows among them, but not very many. And this bothers him. It bothers you to see people go negative. Should. I mean, this is a part of a normal experience. Health tests. This is a part of the aging process. We get the death gene, 2 Corinthians 4, 16 through 18. And you're not going to get away from this. He talks about all the things that happen, but we don't lose heart. But though our outer man is decaying, you got the natural ravages of aging that are going to affect you. You're going to get slower. Slower breath, and one day closer to death. Shorter of breath. That's it, isn't it? Pink Floyd. Shorter of breath, and one day closer to death. That's what everybody gets. Tomorrow, you'll be one day closer to death than you are today. So that's not very encouraging. It's not. No, it's real. It's true. So live life. Again, Solomon would counsel you. Live life, but live it within the parameters of God's word. Know, fear God and keep his commandments. But then live life and enjoy it. Because you're only going to get one shot at this deal. And this idea that Christianity is designed to make people miserable is just the opposite of the truth. Jesus said, I came that they might have life. But people have to be willing, again, to subject themselves to the rigors that are called for if you're going to succeed. Our outer man is decaying. That's a fact. The inner man is being renewed day by day. You can slow the decay. When you see this stop aging, and just turn your TV off, you're being swindled. You're not going to stop the aging process. You might be able to slow it, but the question is, doesn't God have a plan for your life already, how long you're going to live? Obviously, we know there are certain passages that indicate by evil living and stupidity, you can shorten your life. And that's true. I was watching one of these cop shows the other day. I was flipping around and caught it. And apparently the life expectancy, once you try meth, is 7 years. From the first day you try it, your life expectancy is 7 years. Because you won't probably survive it. That's an example of how being stupid can shorten your life expectancy. But God has a plan for you, and you're not going to live. You're not going to make God's plan last 1 second longer for you than he has planned. And so I understand that there are a few things I can do. Bodily exercise is profitable for a little while. So I can exercise, again, the things I can do. Heart, lungs, that kind of thing. Aerobic exercise, strength training, balance. You can work on certain things. But again, you're not going to cheat death by doing that. You can take all the isogenics or whatever supplement you want. And you can buy the latest cream. Whatever it's made out of, some elaborate thing that sells for $85 a thimble, and you think it's going to change you, going to make you better. It won't. It won't lengthen your life. So, health tests, that's a part of it. You're going to be sick. I know with the change of weather, I notice I have more and more problems with allergies when my sinus is bothering me. And I never had that as a kid. I never noticed it at all. I mean, it might have happened, but I didn't pay attention to it that much. It wasn't a big deal, but now as I get older, I see, yeah, there's the weather affects you. Why do you get the aches and pains that go with them? So, momentary, as he says, light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory. And so we don't focus on the fact that, yeah, we are dying, big deal. We're also living at the same time. And I've got a chance to exploit the grace of God and really feather my eternal nest, and now is the time. You got to make hay while the sun shines. Philippians 2, 25 through 30, that's the situation in which I think it was Epaphroditus was sick. And, So this is another one of those things, that this is another verse that would tend to point out that these temporary gifts of like miracles and healings, tongues and certain other factors that are a part of the temporary system of Acts. And during the, as they transitioned into the church age and things got established, it appears certainly, I mean, this is kind of cruel because this is one of the letters written from Paul's Roman imprisonment. The first Roman imprisonment between about 60 and 62 A.D. He was in prison. And he says, he sends Timothy there. Verse 25, I thought it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus, my brother and fellow worker, because he was longing for you and was distressed because you all heard he was sick. Well, see, now my question is, if Paul can do miracles and heal people, why didn't he heal him? I mean, if he has that power still, if that's still a part of the scheme, why doesn't Paul heal him? And the fact is, the temporary gifts were already on their way out. They were very short-lived, didn't last long. And they were already on their way out by 60 A.D., and the church age didn't start till 33. And it doesn't appear that the gospel gets to the Gentiles before, we don't know, we're guessing maybe 37. We're not sure how long that all took. We don't have certain dates there in Acts. The feeling is Paul wasn't saved until about 40 A.D. Or somewhere in there. So, but even then, you know, these things within 20, 30 years, they were there and they were gone. They were just temporary signs to validate the authority of the messengers. How can I know that the Bible can be trusted? Well, there were all these confirmatory signs that were being done by the guys writing it, for one thing. And but soon those passed. Obviously, as they confirmed that they were God's representatives, he didn't need to keep confirming it every day for the rest of their lives. And so he didn't. So he was longing for you and was distressed because you heard he was sick. Indeed, he was sick to the point of death. But God had mercy on him. And not him, but me also, so that I would not have sorrow upon sorrow. This tells me Paul couldn't have healed him. He couldn't have healed him. If he could have, I think he would have. Why would Paul risk the death of somebody he thought was so valuable if he could have healed him? That makes Paul, well, either one, very cruel or very stupid. I'm not sure which. So I don't think there's any way he could have healed him or he would have done it. Therefore, again, he says, I sent him all the more. Living grace tests, 1 Corinthians 4:11. You will have your finances tested, but part of this test is designed to see if you have the proper attitude toward money. If you trust God or you trust your money. Oh. 1 Corinthians 4:11, to this present hour we are both hungry and thirsty. You would think the great apostle God could take care of him better, right? Well, he had to undergo all the same tests, all the sufferings that you and I are going to have to go through. And we are poorly clothed, are roughly treated, and are homeless. Well, we'll give you a bus ticket to somewhere. Where do you want to go? Back to Tarsus? You know, and that's how we'll handle you. And he says, you know, and we toil, working with our own hands. This is just part of the deal. But it was a rigorous ministry that Paul lived. And so obviously, again, as he points out, I made applications. I excelled them all in terms of the testings and the pressures and the things that I went through. Again, it's not a contest. He's not in a contest with Peter or James or John. But the fact is, of the apostles, he suffered more than any of them. And the other apostles suffered, though, however. Many of them were martyred. James was martyred early on there in the book of Acts. Peter is martyred later on. John ends up in exile on Patmos. Paul was killed under the Romans. So, obviously, they all suffered at some levels. 2 Corinthians 11:27. This is in Paul's bragging list, things that he's had to deal with, the documents that from time to time his living grace was said. Now, he didn't do this every day. God didn't constantly just run you through the ringer. But he did have times and periods in his life when he didn't have two nickels to rub together. And then he had other times when he had pretty decent prosperity. He talks about that in the book of Philippians. And he said, I've learned how to deal with both of them. I've learned how to be a poor, and I've learned how to have an abundance. And that's what you have to do. So as he says here, in hunger and thirst, often without food, in cold and in exposure. And Philippians 4:12, that's the passage that deals with that. I know how to get along with humble means. I don't have to eat the highest and the best. Don't have to drink great wine every night. Don't have to have the best of everything. And I know how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and of going hungry, of having an abundance and suffering need. And so, again, your life will be characterized. You will see that there are times when things are financially difficult. There are times when you may have prosperity. Don't let either one of them turn your head. The problem is, most people can't pass the prosperity test. They do okay. I've watched believers over the years. I've watched believers as they struggle. They come up. They don't have much. They really, in many cases, they're almost poor. And they go through life, they apply doctrine, God begins to bless them with some prosperity and all of that, and it turns their head. It distracts them. And ultimately, it can destroy them. I've seen people who just went crazy simply because they came into some money. And they thought that was going to be the end of all their problems. And it wasn't. It's not. Handling prosperity is just another whole different test. Who do you give money to? I mean, let's face it. I mean, if you have an abundance, probably if you got a savings account, we have an abundance, although we should be planning ahead for a rainy day and all that. But how many agencies have got their hand out? I mean, good Lord, if you tried to give a penny to every charitable agency, you'd go broke. Because everybody's got their hand out. So part of having prosperity is figuring out how to use it and when to use it and when not to. I know some people, there many believers I've met over the years, and particularly my first core group, their answer to everything was throw money at it. How are we going to solve this problem? Let's throw money at it. That is not the way to approach your problems. Now, there may be a problem where throwing money at it solves it. That does happen. I'm not saying that never happens. But I'm saying that's not the answer to every problem, throw money at it. If a person, this is one of the things, we have a legitimate living grace deal. If a person runs into financially unexpected hard times and they are otherwise working and taking care of themselves, there would be no shame in coming and asking for help. That's perfectly fine. But the person who's consistently having to ask for help manifests that there's another problem that throwing money at it's not going to solve. You've got to teach them how to live. You've got to teach them, and the fact is, this is why we're here. We have human examples, even failing human examples, like your pastor. But I have set an example over the years of taking care of myself, not being in debt, not running up credit cards, having money when I needed it. And that's not to say that believers haven't applied towards me. They have, and I've appreciated that, but I don't have to rely on that. I mean, that may be some time where I have to. I have to say, well, I'm completely flat broke and need help. But to this point, God hadn't done that. But I tried to set an example of diligence, staying on top of it, living on a budget, living within my means. I don't have to have. I heard, one deal, one guy was, why would the pastor's house be nicer than mine? It shouldn't be. Well, that's just stupid. But anyway, I don't have to have the highest. I don't have to live on Longboat Key. It's fine. I'm content with what I've got. And that goes a long way in life, just being content. If you just are content with what you have, you're not miserable because you're not constantly striving to get something else. So living grace will be tested. Verbal abuse, this will come from people who can't keep their mouths shut. They have to express their hostility. The book of 1 Peter is largely about this, in fact. This was what they were facing in the Roman Empire. This is just the beginnings of the persecution under Nero. But talk was circulating in the empire, and Christians were being painted in a very negative light. They were being painted as antinomian, anti-authority, anti-Caesar, anti-government, essentially. And so this was becoming a problem. Well, it wasn't true. But then again, what you do have is, number one, you've got believers who can go out and misapply and bring a bad name on Christianity. That happens. Go out and live their life, and people say, oh, look at that, that's a Christian. And it gives a black eye to the body of Christ. But then you got people, as Paul would talk about, false brethren, who weren't even really saved, but their lifestyles would often reflect back on the church just because they claimed to be saved. They said they were saved, and so therefore they were viewed as, quote, Christians. But they were still very pagan in their orientation. Well, that made the church look bad as well. And so the talk was circulating among the Roman Empire that Christians, that they were anti-authority, therefore they didn't like, they were encouraging slaves to rebel against their masters. That was not true. You read the writings, and Paul's not an advocate for abolition. Paul wasn't an abolitionist. Peter wasn't an abolitionist. They encourage believers, if you're a slave, you submit to your master. If you're a master, you treat your slaves right. But they didn't say, we got to throw the whole system out. Well, you can't do that. And so the fact is, again, they weren't doing the things they were accused of doing. Real believers weren't or shouldn't have been. But they were, again, the talk was circulating, and we know how this goes. Once it's said, it can't be unsaid. 1 Timothy 3, keep a good conscience, so that in the thing in which you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior will be put to shame. And also 4:4, and in all this they are surprised that you don't run with them in the same excess of dissipation, and they malign you. And so that you're going to have that. You're going to have people badmouth you. Okay. The trick there is to not let it bother you. You know, sticks and stones kind of deal. I'm rubber. You know. And that's the only way you can approach that, because if you let it bother you and you start thinking about it, you'll retaliate. Tit for tat, right back at them. We want to try to avoid that. And it's all too easy to just give it right back to them, isn't it? And half the time they deserve it anyway, you know that. But God tells us, leave it in my hands. I will take care of this. If they're going to mistreat you, leave it to me. Suffering under some unfair authority. Jesus' life obviously manifested this. John 18. He suffered under many unfair authorities, the religious authorities, the civil authorities, both completely in the wrong here, and yet murdered him anyway. John 18, 19. The high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. And Jesus said, I have openly spoken to the world. I have always taught in the synagogues and in the temple, where all the Jews came together. I spoke nothing in secret. Why do you question me? Question those who have heard what I spoke to them. They know what I said. And when he said this, one of the officers standing nearby struck Jesus. Well, this is illegal. You can't do this. And I've watched, as I've watched some of these, I don't try to watch too many reality shows, but sometimes I'll flip around and I'll catch them. And I'm just stunned at the level, oftentimes, of a force that cops use that's just not necessary. But you put a little bitty power in a little bitty man's hands. And in many cases, it goes to his little bitty head. And I watch him and I think, you know, you can handcuff that guy without putting your knee in between his shoulder blades. You can handcuff him without doing that, you know. You don't have to have his knee on the side of his head smashing his face down into the pavement. That's not necessary to handcuff a person, particularly if they're not resisting. And I've been flipping around the other day and I caught a guy and he said, I'm not resisting, man, I'm not resisting. And they were right on top of him. And the guy's telling him, I'm not resisting, don't tase me, here's my hands. And I watched the force, the level of force that's used. And I think, and we're not talking life or death situations here, we're talking, you know, taking down some guy in a physical race. We're not talking he wasn't pulling a gun, he didn't have a knife, he wasn't violent in that sense. He was fleeing. But here's another little rule of thumb. Don't run from the police. But if you're guilty, running is what you're going to want to do. So, but again, I watch all this stuff. So you got authorities out there that abuse authority. I understand that. Things are done that are not strictly legal. You really can't arrest a guy. And I don't know if it's true here, but I was watching a show the other night, and she said, we can hold this guy for 72 hours without charging him. Well, when did that become law? To be held against your will with no charges being leveled against you, I thought was illegal. I didn't think that was a part of due process. And so, again, authorities can be abusive. We get this. Husbands can be abusive. Pastors can be abusive. Teachers can be abusive. Pick any authority in the world. Parents. No, nobody's perfect. And this is one of the things you'll deal with. Well, Jesus had to deal with it. Obviously he deals with that there. Then in 19, he's under Pilate, another unfair authority, who knows he's innocent and won't turn him loose. He knows the guy is innocent. Will you talk about a miscarriage of justice? I mean, here he knows this guy is innocent and won't do the right thing. You can also see Colossians here, 3:21. Fathers who are supposed to set an example and raise their children in the discipline and instruction of the Lord can become abusive. We're not talking about legitimate discipline. By the way, poor Adrian Peterson, what are they going to make this guy do? Lick all their boots till they're happy? He spanked his kid, for God's sake. Get over it. And I'm not saying he did it necessarily in the right way, but what parent hasn't done that? And I love the way they turn it from a spanking into a beating. The language itself has become inflammatory in this. He beat him with a tree branch. It was a switch. He didn't take a 40-pound tree branch and crush the kid with it. The language is inflammatory the way they present it in the first place. It's designed to elicit a gut response that this was abuse, horrible, horrible abuse. And maybe, was it a little too far? Maybe. I don't know. I got swished with a switch. It didn't kill me. It drew blood, I can tell you that. A willow switch will draw blood. It'll give you a little bitty cut. But I've gotten paper cuts and I didn't die from them either. And again, I don't personally think it was abusive. I didn't see the whole thing. But if a child doesn't discipline a parent, or if a parent doesn't discipline a kid, all you're going to have when you grow up is a little antinomian. Only he'll be a big antinomian who won't be able to deal in life because he's never been told no. And this is where kids have to just be reined in. Well, again, parents can be abusive. Fathers, don't exasperate your children so that they do not lose heart. You don't want to put too much on them. 1 Peter 2:18 deals with slaves and masters. Slaves, be obedient to your masters, even to those who are unfair. So you can have unfair authority. Now, the goal of any authority is to try to use your authority responsibly. Just exercise it within the parameters in which it's supposed to be exercised and not in an abusive way. To just deal with the authority you have and whatever it is, whether you're a parent, a teacher, a pastor, anything, whatever authority, husband, pick authority. You just want to exercise your authority consistent with what the Word of God says. Because if you overstep on this authority factor, you're going to get into trouble yourself. And so we don't want to do that. But, well, again, you suffer under unfair authorities. It happens. Temptations from within and from without. Hebrews 2:17 and 18. This is a part of suffering. By the time you get some doctrine under your belt and you grow up and you figure certain things out, you get to where you just as soon be shed of this sin nature. It's not a fun deal carrying it around all the time. Hebrews 2:17, therefore he had to be made like his brothers in all things, so that he might become a faithful high priest. In other words, he had to suffer everything you and I had to suffer. How would he know what we were going through if he couldn't relate, if he hadn't suffered it? So he suffers all the things we suffer, but, generally speaking, in worse circumstances, in his niche. For since he was tempted in that which he has suffered, he is able to come to the aid of those who are tempted. And also 4:15, for we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. He didn't sin. He didn't give in to it. But he suffered the temptation. And that's a part of suffering. The suffering that comes from orientation to one's niche, one's time in history. And the relative isolation the believers endure, and particularly positive believers. 2 Timothy 1:15. Because we are a small, elect, select group of people. People say, well, you think you're better than other believers? Oh, hell yeah. Absolutely I do. I mean, believers who don't know the Bible, yeah, I'm certainly better off than they are. Believers who don't apply what they hear, yeah, I'm better off than they are too. And the believers that don't even understand basic principles like rebound, so they never even actually get back in fellowship, yeah, I'm way better off than they are. I'm glad to have the doctrine we have. Now, I don't think it's not anything to me. I have nothing to be arrogant about. There's no boasting. Because all the doctrine we've got, what have you received that you did? What do you have, rather, that you did not receive? God's provided all the teaching under the ministry of the Holy Spirit. So what we have by grace. And so I'm grateful for that. But is that better than the people that don't have it? Yeah. I mean, if I say to you, would you like to have a cake or no cake? You know? Cake? No cake. Which one do you want? I'll take cake. Well, if you have the cake, you're better off than the guy with no cake. That's just the facts. And what we do know is that the relative level of understanding out there in Christendom is appalling. I mean, even among, quote, doctrinal groups, they're goofy, many of them. And that's sad. But we can avoid all that, again, just by sticking with what we have here. So as you live, you know, you become more and more isolated. I get that. Let's see, who is Jesus? A man of sorrows, acquainted with grief? We hid our face from him? Don't you think Jesus lived in surrounded by people almost all the time, but in relative isolation? Because he knew he was unique. And he knew what the plan of God was for him and how it was going to play out. 2 Timothy 1:15. And you are aware of the fact that all who are in Asia turned away from me. This is an area, Asia Minor he's talking about there. This is the area where Ephesus was, Galatia was in that region. All these churches that Paul founded. And he said, basically, once things went south, guess what? They all abandoned me. They turned away from me. I'm left here alone. He's alone in prison. Very few people. He wasn't totally alone. And that we can deal with as well. For instance, you look in verse 16. Among whom he mentions two distinct guys, Phygellus and Hermogenes, forever recorded in the Bible as abandoning Paul at his hour of need. Oh, Demas is there as well. And then you got Hymenaeus and Alexander. So these guys are going to be notorious, I think, at some level. Because they serve as examples, negative examples of what not to do. This is it. But then you got a positive example, like the Lord grant mercy to the house of Onesiphorus. For he often refreshed me and was not ashamed of my chains. And when he was in Rome, he sought me out. He made sure that he came and provided for me what he could do. Well, guess what? He's up for a lot of blessing. The other guys, not so much. And then James 5, 4 through 6. This is actually a prophecy with respect to the very last days. It's an interesting prophecy. Because it deals with the super rich of the last days. It's not just the rich in general. We're talking about the elite super rich, the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, the people that have hidden money in all manner of places, and so you don't really know how rich they are. One of the things you can tell how well they're doing is how many political offices they hold and where they are in terms. Some of them will stay out of the scenes. They just act as, quote, advisors. They don't want the spotlight. Well, they don't want the spotlight shined on what they're doing. That's for sure. They don't. And so in James here, he says, come now, you rich. Weep and howl for your miseries which are coming on you. Your riches have rotted and your garments have become moth-eaten. Your silver, your gold and your silver have rusted. Well, gold and silver don't rust. They just don't. And so what he's talking about here forces the interpreter to go beyond what we would look at as a regular interpretation, because what kind of rust was going to attack or destroy gold or silver? And I would suggest to you, radioactive rust will do it. And he says here, this is going to it's going to consume your flesh like fire. It's in the last days you have stored up your treasure. We live in a world where just the relative difference between the rich and the poor is so big. I mean, so large, because you don't really know. They talk about billionaires. These people are beyond billionaires. They control and manipulate money at the highest levels. And manipulate politicians and governments at the highest levels. They are systematically dismantling this country, if you can't tell. I mean, those of us who've lived for 40, 50, 60 years, you can see it. That they have systematically dismantled it. They're destroying one nation under God. Now we're Italian Americans, Afro Americans, Jewish Americans, Polish Americans. Nobody's an American American, that's for sure. We don't have any of those. And so it's divide and conquer. And that's the easiest way to that's the easiest way to take down any organization. Divide them into their little constituent groups and then conquer them one at a time. Get them afraid of each other. Class warfare is great. A monetary manipulation through the stock market and through the Fed, that's great. You can do this stuff. Manipulation of our educational system through revisionist history, where you don't hear what the truth was, you hear their version of the truth sanitized for your protection. Yeah, who are they protecting? They're protecting themselves. They don't want the truth out about what these people are doing. It's a global affair. They intend to be a global affair. They want to run the entire planet. And see, in that regard, they reflect the views of their daddy, Satan. That's all they're doing. And ultimately, this will congeal into the form and finally coalesce into the form of one man. They'll find one guy that suits them all. That guy's called Antichrist. So we live in a time where the elite rich, behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields and which have been withheld by you cries out against you. We move Nike and these other companies out of America to the Philippines and to India and other places and outsource our labor. Why? Because it's cheap, 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 cheap. They won't pay them a livable wage. You may work for $1 a day. You may not even work for that much. You may live in deplorable conditions. And guess what? Record profits on Wall Street this week. And I'm all for profits. Don't get me wrong. I'm not a socialist at all. I'm a capitalist through and through. But the reality is they have starved people for money and the details of life. They've abused people. They've killed people for money and the details of life. And to advance their hideous agenda. You have lived luxuriously, he says. Well, this they cry out against you, and the outcry has reached the Lord of the armies. That's what Sabaoth means. It's a Hebrew transliteration into the Greek. It's reached the Lord of the armies, and guess what? He's fixing to turn the armies loose. This is a threat of military intervention by the Lord. That's what this is. And it's coming. It's coming in a big way. So you have lived luxuriously on the earth and you led a life of wanton pleasure. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You have condemned and put to death the righteous man. And he does not resist you. As believers, we have to take it. We live under this oppressive system. It's neither social nor secure. We have a system of taxation that favors the rich. I'm not against, I'm not for graded taxation either. I think people ought to all pay the same. But you shouldn't be able to move your country to Bermuda and then not pay taxes here while all your offices are here. And your plants are here and your manufacturing's here. But you pull this little stunt and you get away with it. Well, again, the corporations are running the country. We know this. If we expect reform, we're going to have it now that Republicans control things. Oh, good grief. These people can't do anything. They're worse. That Oompa Loompa Boehner, I mean, I don't know where he gets his coloring from, but he needs to look into something else. The idea that they're going to fix this is just a delusion. And it's an illusion. It's not going to happen. Okay, well, time's gone. We'll stop there. We'll pick up here in our second session. Let's take our normal 20-minute break.